When I was a young boy, I guess about 8 or 9 years old, I remember thinking, I used to lie in bed sometimes and look up at the ceiling and say, God, I know you're up there. I don't know who you are, but help! Really, though, I actually used to think like that. Then I went to school, went to junior school, high school, and that's when my troubles really began. I was always getting into trouble. I was always in the principal's office for one reason or another. In high school, you know, like most devotees, I didn't have any problem with school. I always got, you know, very good marks. But I was just so miserable and so unhappy. I couldn't see any meaning to life. So I kept thinking ahead, okay, you graduate from school. Okay, your parents want you to go to university, so you go to university. Okay, that's not it. Then you get a job, then you get married, then you work for 20 years, then you retire, you get a little home in Florida, and then you die. It just didn't seem worth it. When I was young, I would go to church. My parents really weren't churchgoers, but we were Anglican, which is like the Catholic Church of America. Anglican Church was the English church where the king wanted to get a divorce, so he formed his own church. Still, wanted to remain Catholic, but wanted to get a divorce, so... Who was it? Henry VIII or something? Anyway, so I used to go to church, and... You know, again, it was nice, but... I wasn't satisfied. They couldn't answer my questions. One life, that was my biggest problem. One life. Didn't make sense. So then, by that time I was really frustrated. And I went to college. Although I had straight A's in school, I flunked in my first year of college. Practically failed all my exams. Except for English and math. And I joined Campus Crusade for Christ. And, you know, that just didn't do it either. Again, it wasn't a question of... They just didn't have the philosophy. And so then I dropped out of school. And I started living with some alternative people. And doing a little pharmaceutical research. And then things really started to make sense. So one day in 1968, I was walking downtown. I was, again, doing space research, quite elevated space research, and I saw these devotees. They were traveling. It was, I think, the first party in Canada. Actually, it was Hansa Dutta and a group of brahmacharis, and they were traveling, and they passed through Vancouver, and they were chanting out front of the library. And I saw them, and they were chanting, and they were radioactive. They were glowing. And I thought, who are these guys? And so I just kind of stood in front of the Sankirtan party for about half an hour, and then I tripped on. And that was the first time I met them. And then by that time, I was really trying to find a group of people who were serious about answering the questions of life. I was looking into what, in those days, there were a lot of what we called communes. I don't know if you've heard of that word, commune, but okay.
You were a communist.
Community, yeah. Oh yeah, you're communists. Okay. So anyway, there were a lot of hippie communes happening at that time. But mostly everybody was, you know, the motto was love and peace. You know, love and peace, brother. But I really found out that it was just lust and sleep. So I was seriously trying to find out the answers to life, and, you know, someone passed me a joint, and, you know, everybody slept together. So that turned me right off. That wasn't it. They weren't serious people. So when, and I couldn't figure out the answer to life's problems. It was too difficult. There were so many suffering people in the world. There was evil in the world. I was reading, doing a lot of reading. I was a very avid reader. And I had read Alan Watts. I don't know if you've heard of Alan Watts. He was a contemporary of Timothy Leary. I don't know if you've heard of Timothy Leary, but, okay, lysergic acid diethyltryptamate. That was Timothy Leary. So Alan Watts was a professor. They were all actually scholars. Or at least they weren't scholars, but they were professors. So I'd read a number of Tibetan books also. I was looking for answers, but not finding any person or any group of people that lived what they were talking about. And so then I was walking down the street one day, and I turned the corner, and there was the Sankirtan party. And the devotees were jumping up and down in front of the department store, and, you know, tambourines and you know, collecting money. And one devotee walked up to me and handed me a card, and all I can remember was he said, "You're not this body." The semester said something else, but that was the only thing that stuck, and it just, boing, eureka, that's it. That was the answer to all the questions I had. I am not the body. So then that was the next contact I had with devotees. And then, like every good young person at that time, I made a pilgrimage to San Francisco. And again, I was looking at communes there. And then the first devotee I actually met and talked to, his name was Babu Brahan. And I've seen him, really nice devotee. But anyway, the meeting I had was interesting. He was selling incense. He had a table. He had a big picture of Vishnu, and he had incense on the table. It was in Berkeley, California, which was at that time the most active counterculture university in the whole world, I guess, but certainly in the U.S. And there were so many young people there, revolutionaries and reactionaries and hippies and yippies and whatever. And so the devotees were there, and he had this table. He had a big picture of Vishnu, framed picture, glass and everything. And so I walked up to the table, and I was looking at his incense, and then I looked at the picture, and I said, "Who is that?" And he said, in a strong Brooklyn accent, "That's God." And I was shocked, you know, God, like, you know, four arms and, you know, big snake behind him. And so I challenged him. I said, "Oh, yeah?" I said, "What if I broke the picture?" You know, I thought I got him there. He said, "Well," said, "I guess I'd have to kill you." "Oh, yeah?" I walked away quickly. But I got a card. I went to the Sunday feast in San Francisco, and that was when I first actually got to know the devotees. I walked in the temple, and I met Jayananda, and he was my Bhagma Pradarshak guru. He immediately grabbed me, and the first service I ever learned was how to roll Simply Wonderfuls with two hands. It was, you know, most people just roll it with one, you know. I learned two hands simultaneously. It was an advanced skill in Krishna consciousness. And then he gave me some other services, and then there was the Sunday feast. And, you know, that was it. I mean, I knew immediately that this was the answer to all my questions. I sat with devotees, I talked to them, they explained the philosophy, I chanted, I danced, and then I tasted those Simply Wonderfuls. And that was it, I was finished. And, you know, then I met Prabhupada in Los Angeles a little while later, and that's another story. That was really, I had a mystical experience when I met Prabhupada. It was very beautiful. It's another story. I'll give someone else a chance now. It was after Ratha Yatra. It was 1970. I'd been living in the temple for about a year. And it was Ratha Yatra time in San Francisco, and Prabhupada came. And so it was San Francisco, and we had a little small temple. And we had always been told that Prabhupada was a pure devotee, and that we had been wandering throughout the universe for millions and millions of lifetimes. And now, finally, after millions of births, now we were getting the chance to meet Krishna's representative who had descended from the spiritual world to save us. And here he was, and we were going to meet him. And I was pretty jacked up, as they say. I was pretty psyched up. But that really doesn't matter. He didn't have to be psyched up to like Prabhupada. But anyway, it was Friday night. Ratha Yatra was on Saturday. And Prabhupada had arrived in San Francisco, and we were all there in the temple. It was actually the first time I had seen so many devotees. Devotees had come from all over the West Coast and all over. They'd come from the east of the eastern USA, and there were about 300 devotees, something like that. It was a huge number in those days. And so it was really exciting for me, because prior to that, we were just a little small temple, and Krishna consciousness seemed nice, but, you know, it was just kind of like, you know, Prabhupada said someday we were going to take over the world, all 10 of us, but, you know, we weren't quite sure how it was going to happen. So then there was all 300, 400 devotees, and it was really exciting. And Prabhupada was coming, and almost 300 or 400 of those devotees, not that many, but it seemed like that many, were packed into the temple room in the San Francisco temple. And there was an ecstatic kirtan going on. And Prabhupada was supposed to arrive at 7 o'clock, and it was 10 to 7, and the kirtan started going faster and faster. Everybody was ecstatic. Someone came in and said, "Prabhupada's coming, Prabhupada's coming." And we got even more ecstatic and wild. Everybody started to dance in a frenzy. And then Prabhupada arrived, and they opened the door, and in walked this dainty, you know, means, what's the word for dainty, petite, beautiful old man. I thought he was going to be big and strong and, you know, but he was just, he was like a darling, you know, he was just someone you wanted to protect, and he was so beautiful. And everything he did was so aristocratic. The way he walked with his cane, and the way he smiled, and you know, everything, the way he drank, you know, it wasn't just like, you know, but it's like just drinking a glass of beer or something, but you know, everything he did was so sweet. And they opened the door, and in walked Prabhupada, and you know, the kirtan immediately stopped, and everyone just hit the floor. It seemed like it was, you know, like it seemed like we just hit the floor. I can remember just being shuddering, my whole body shuddering. And I was offering my obeisances, and I was crying. I was sobbing, actually. And I felt that he reached out and touched my heart. I heard other people crying too, and offering our obeisances. And I just, right from the first moment I saw him, I felt that he was so pure and in another universe. He had that vibration, and when he touched me for a few moments, I felt like I'd taken the most purifying bath. Sometimes when you're sweaty and dirty and exhausted, and you know you get under the shower and you smother yourself in soap, and it just feels so good. So I felt like my soul had just been washed clean of so much sin. And then I got up, we all got up, and I couldn't take my eyes off him. And he walked in the temple room from the door. The door was on the right-hand side, and the Vyasam was on the left-hand side. So he walked through the devotees. Everybody got out of the way. It looked like it was a giant bubble around us. It was a beatific vision, I guess. I never experienced anything like it in my life. Never since then or before then. And even I wasn't much of a hallucinator on acid, so, you know, it was a bubble around all of us, and he was outside the bubble. And wherever he would walk, the bubble would recede. It would, and he would walk, and the bubble, he was outside, but it couldn't, the bubble of illusion couldn't touch him. And he walked over to the Vyasasan, and he sat down on the Vyasasan, and he started, you know, to play his kartals and sing Jai Radha Madhava, and it was so beautiful, and I was enjoying every millisecond of it. And then he stopped kirtan, and then he started to speak on the Bhagavad Gita, and he coughed. He stopped speaking, and he coughed. And then he was quoting a verse, and he forgot the Sanskrit or some words. And immediately my mind began to criticize. And then the vision disappeared. I lost it. When I was offering him my respect and love, I was able to see him But when I wanted to criticize him